folks. Rob Wolf here, Greg Everett. This is episode 106, right, man?
It is indeed.
Sweet. What's new?
That's four less than 110.
I cannot argue,
man,
with you on that.
Nothing is new at all. Although I'm pretty sure that my not drinking coffee at all this week is not working.
Was this kind of a adrenal relocation program kind of gig or what?
Yes, one of the several I've tried over the last couple of years. And I'm pretty sure that I've slept worse without drinking coffee this whole week.
Yeah, I could see you being a paradoxical responder. Uppers or downers and vice versa.
So you're telling me I need to go drink a bunch of coffee right now?
Probably.
Yes. All right. I trust you.
I'm also of the opinion that a better lived life that is shorter is better than a longer lived life that sucks. So,
how's the relocation, the total body life relocation?
Oh, man, it's in process. So what, last week I was in Reno and we did the podcast, or I recorded from here. Then I spent a week in Chico and we've got a couple of new hire prospects that are looking really good. And now I'm back in Reno, going to fly back to New Mexico, take 2 days to pack up the wife, the gato, and a few goodies, and drive back out to Reno and set up shop. So it's kind of a whirlwind. I'm ready to be in one spot for a long time and curtail my travel schedule and call it good.
Yes, yes. Well, it makes a big difference on the quality of life, I can tell you that.
Indeed.
When I stopped doing travel seminars, I instantly got happier. No offense, guys.
It's always fun when you're there, but the coming and going is definitely a kick to the jimmy. So, yeah, it'll be good. So, yeah, that's all I've got. Anything new on the Catalyst side of the fence?
No, we got a new article out about warming up, like an actual warm-up.
Mm-hmm.
People have liked that one so far.
Aggressive. Cool.
Yeah. And that's about it.
Sweet.
Still working on all these undisclosed projects.
It will remain undisclosed for an undisclosed period.
I'll eventually be able to disclose them, yeah.
Sweet.
It's, with all this buildup now.
Yeah, they better
all right,
be pretty
well,
good at this point.
Shall we dip into the mailbag here?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. Catherine says, "Hi, guys. I eat a paleo diet with some non-guilty cheat meals when I'm out socializing. I work out regularly. I'm a triathlete who moderately trains in my sport and trains with free weights 50% of the time. And in terms of body comp, I'm a 5'7 female, 130 pounds, fairly lean, meaning jeans fit great, but I have a 2-pack, not a 6-pack. My problem is that 2 days before my period, I have a burning desire to stuff my face with chocolate and carbs. I try to eat dark chocolate, but I'm never satisfied. That's because dark chocolate's kind of gross. Last month, I even made homemade pudding with dark chocolate, maple syrup, pastured cinnamon butter, and pastured heavy cream. Damn, it was good. But at the end of my pudding binge, I was still unsatisfied. What is a female body actually craving before and during periods? I'd like to find out what nutrients my body is craving so that I can supplement it with correct foods rather than raiding my cupboards like Gollum, that creepy dude from Lord of the Rings. Thanks."
That paints some pretty good imagery there. You know, I would be willing to bet that you probably, if we were to do some blood work on you, probably have a little estrogen dominance. And during the normal cycle, I'm wiggling my hands in the air very ineffectively because this is actually radio and not television. So nonetheless, I'm still wiggling my hands in the air, tracing a graph. And if we were to graph estrogen and progesterone over time, the estrogen goes up to a peak and then starts declining. And that's the growth or proliferation phase. And then the progesterone typically bypasses estrogen, ideally it does, and that's where you either begin your period subsequent to that, or if you have a fertilized egg, then the high progesterone levels induce the implantation of the egg and you get pregnant and all that sort of happy stuff. So a lot of folks, particularly females, for a variety of reasons, ranging from like environmental estrogens to liver toxicity issues and stuff like that, they have a little bit of estrogen dominance, and it can drag this stuff out a little bit. And so instead of the transition going from estrogen to progesterone being kind of smooth, it's not as smooth, and folks get these really gnarly cravings for sugar and stuff like that. So one thing that you could consider is looking into like calcium deglucarate. One is going in and getting some blood work and kind of confirming this stuff, but you're going to have to do it both early in your cycle, mid-cycle, and then late cycle to get a complete picture of what's going on with this and actually see if this looks like you've got a little bit of an estrogen dominance kind of gig. But you could do some things like calcium deglucarate and some of the other estrogen detox methodologies to help you manage that. You could do some things like chromium picolinate and some alpha lipoic acid that can maybe help with carb cravings a little bit, but I think it's got much more to do with the kind of hormonal status. And honestly, I wouldn't freak out about it too much. This whole thing with the pudding and dark chocolate and maple syrup sounds kind of wacky, honestly. But you said it was good, so I guess knock yourself out on that. But that's some stuff that you could look at to just see if you do have some hormonal irregularities. And if you do, and if you come to a point where you want to get pregnant, I don't see an age in this, but if you do have the estrogen dominance, you do want to get pregnant down the road, you're probably going to find that a little bit challenging because, again, the implantation of the egg is very dependent upon progesterone levels. So just maybe a thing that you could do to get a little baseline, understand where you are with your hormonal status, and if you do anything to address that, then it should help with the cravings too.
All righty. Kai says, hi, first, thanks for the podcast and book. It's had a huge impact on my life. My question is about reverse osmosis filtered water, a bit outside the usual question stream, I know. The tap water in my R has fluoride. Means in my house or
area?
Area. Yeah. That's probably more likely. Chlorine and who knows what else in it. To strip out all the crap, I have a reverse osmosis filter on my tap. This removes everything, including the minerals in the water, including magnesium and other such good stuff. So the question, can food sources replace the minerals being pulled out of my water, or should I just drink the good with the bad? Just asking for opinion, not clinical advice. Winking smiley face.
Sweet. I think in general you would get plenty of minerals from a decent, mixed paleo-type diet if you want to take a kind of a multi-mineral kind of gig. I'm not a real big fan of multivites, but a multi-mineral gig that's not real heavy in calcium, you could take that a couple of times a week, and that would probably be fine. There's some stuff out there like the congen water, which they've got some kind of wacky claims associated with it, but what it does is kind of a reverse osmosis kind of process to remove things like fluoride and, other organic solvents and things like that that get in the water. It removes that stuff, but then it has a mineral pack in it that then it reintroduces minerals to the water. So there's some stuff that you could do like that, but I honestly don't think it's that big of a deal one way or the other. Kind of the opinion that the filtered water is probably a better idea. Kind of proof editing Professor Cordain's new book that's coming out, and he does a really good chapter on water and water quality and some of the nasty stuff that's in the water and some of the consequences of like the halogenated getting fluorine or chlorine associated with organic molecules, and those things can be kind of gnarly from a toxicology standpoint, and so figuring out some strategies for kind of minimizing that. It makes some sense from a health and longevity deal. There's also some issues with gut bacteria, and if you're taking in a lot of halogens, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, usually not consuming a lot of bromine, but that stuff just wreaks havoc on gut bacteria. So if you're trying to take some probiotics, that's definitely a consideration. So, Greg, thoughts on water?
Just to address these questions before they even come up, what's your objection to the calcium and the multi-mineral?
There's some pretty good research that shows that specific calcium supplementation increases cardiac events, so like stroke and heart attack. And this is one of the funny things where, and you know, we do, I don't think we really see this from food, even if people are eating yogurt and stuff like that, but it's one of those things where people are all spun up about bone mineral density. And instead of lifting some weights, getting some vitamin D, either via supplementation or being out in the sun, you know, they're just kind of packing a bunch of calcium down their pie hole. But the thing that precipitates, or one of the key elements in the precipitation of the clotting cascade, is free calcium. So that is a pretty concerning thing for me, like recommending just kind of carte blanche calcium supplementation for folks, I think is pretty dangerous, honestly. And if people have bone mineral density issues, then they need to do some systemic things to address that. Lift weights, you know, weight-bearing exercise, vitamin D levels, make sure acid-base balance is kind of dealt with by not being metabolically deranged. If you're borderline type 2 diabetic, then you're in a elevated cortisol state, which is inducing this metabolic acidosis and leaching calcium out of the bones. I'm not as concerned, and Matt Lalonde has kind of, you know, raged on about this, and rightly so, about the specific acid-base balance of the diet, but there are other metabolic consequences of say, like being overweight or being type 2 diabetic that I think do induce some metabolic acidosis that could be very, very concerning. So in the case of the supplement, the calcium, potentially, in my opinion, a clotting promoter.
All right. Well, that's fair enough. Ashley says, "Hey, Rob, I have a million questions I want to ask you, but this is one of personal and professional interest to me. I'm looking to write an article on the subject, so I was wondering if you had any smart/medical/professional advice on this one."
That's a lot of slashing.
So smart is only an option. It doesn't have to be smart. It could be medical or professional.
But
I've heard a lot of nonsense from strict paleo followers about how they've retrained their taste buds to the point where junk food tastes gross, and something like a carrot can taste almost too sweet. See what I mean by ridiculous? I have experienced this myself to an extent. After eating very, very strict paleo for a few months, I discovered that my cravings for sweet things largely went away, and I was craving other healthier options. Still, I could go a year without eating a piece of cake, and the first moment that sweet, sweet ambrosia hits my lips, it's like it never went away. It doesn't taste gross at all. And just like an addict, the more I indulge, the more I want, and the more I crave it. Anyway, while I feel I have become more attuned to the subtle flavors and sweetness of natural foods, unadorned with sugar, MSG, or cream sauces, I'm still skeptical about the whole retraining your taste buds thing. Is there science behind this? Is there any research out there about the legitimacy of actually adjusting your sense of taste? Or is this a reaction that depends utterly on the person and their disposition towards sweet, salty, healthy, unhealthy, etc.? Thanks in advance for your thoughts."
You know, I think that there is something to this, in that it's almost like a volume acclimatization smell and taste are very tightly tuned. And so maybe the smell element of this is a little bit more intuitive. If you walk into a room where folks are wearing some pretty strong perfume or cologne, you smell it very, very intensely initially. But then a couple of minutes later, you know, an hour later, you can't really smell it at all. So you get this kind of downregulation of the sensory input from that stuff. I think that there's something pretty similar to this based around taste. I know for me, I don't, you know, there's just not really that much stuff I crave. You know, every once in a while I might want something. But generally the only time that I do is when I've been eating poorly. And then I tend to start wanting more of that type of stuff. And I think that, you know, Stefan Guinet has talked a lot about, like, the palatability, you know, considerations of overeating and obesity. I do think that there are some foods that are, you know, hyperpalatable, can bypass the normal satiety centers in the brain. And that can obviously be a problem from, like, almost a food addiction kind of perspective. And if you're just foregoing that stuff, I guess for some people, maybe the stuff is so over the top, you know, sensory overload when they first taste like a chocolate cake and they haven't eaten anything like that in a long time. I could kind of see that. Something to keep in mind too is you have a, just as a baseline out in the population, you have a broad spectrum of what things people can and can't taste and smell. And you have certain people who are, you know, they call them super tasters, and they oftentimes can be problematic to feed because they literally have like a greater density of taste buds, greater density of olfactory nerve endings in their mouth and nose. And so they just take in more sensory data, and they may taste bitter flavors more intensely and whatnot. So I think that there's a number of different factors. You got some genetic variability. Some people will taste things to a greater or lesser degree. So you have to kind of factor that in. Then you have to look at the fact that some modern foods are absolutely hyper palatable. I think arguing against that fact is kind of moronic at this point. You know, it's like, what you know, apples taste pretty damn good, but like I have one apple and I'm like, okay, I'm good. We got some chocolate covered almond bark the other day, which was actually a high content, you know, it was like an 80% dark chocolate. But dude, I could eat 6 pounds of that stuff. You know, there's no off switch on that. So there's some really big differences in the palatability of some of the modern foods versus the, you know, just standard like fruit and veggies and all that. So I think, you know, as with all of this stuff, I think there's more to the story than just kind of a yes, no answer on this. There's a spectrum of genetic predispositions with regards to taste. We've got some hyper palatable foods. Different people are going to react to that different ways. Some people may in fact be overwhelmed by the taste of refined foods if they haven't been eating it for a long time. I don't see that super surprising. I don't know that everybody's going to be that way. I know I'm really not that way. If you put crappy food in front of me, it just makes me want to eat a whole lot of crappy food. So, but that doesn't mean that everybody's wired up that way.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have retained my taste for certain things, but generally like super sweet things, I don't enjoy them anymore like I did when I was younger. So
yeah, I remember eating,
the short answer is yes,
I remember eating Pixie Sticks and thinking that that was kind of a good idea, and you know, something that was kind of cool as a kid. And I think I you know, reasonably well as a kid, I actually tended to kind of gravitate more towards like fruits and vegetables. But I remember doing things like eating Pixie Sticks, which is just basically a tube of sugar, you know, with like artificial colors in it to make it pass through the blood brain barrier even faster. So, and something sweet like that now I would not want at all. But again, you throw me some dark chocolate or some nachos, I'm in. I'm testicle deep on that. I'm good to go.
All right. Well, while you were talking, I finally read the last paragraph of this next question, and it just makes it even better. All right. Ricardo says, "Hey, Rob, I've been doing a gluten-free, low omega-6, low fructose diet for 3 years now, and I followed your podcast since the first episode. Sometimes I do zone out while listening to it, and I wasn't sure if you mentioned anything about Miracle Fruities. And that's spelled Frooties. I stumbled upon a product called Miracle Fruities a week ago. When you dissolve the tablet in your mouth, it coats it and changes the receptors on the tongue to perceive sour as sweet. Have you heard of this product, and would it be a good alternative to satisfy the munchies with a healthy snack enhanced with Miracle Fruities? You think it is just as bad as other artificial sweeteners? Also, you don't need to include this part in the podcast, but we're going to.
This really ties it all together.
This is key, Ricardo. This is the underlying theme here. But what is your point of view on marijuana and its effects on long-term health and strength training? I'm just curious. Thanks.
So, dude, I smoked a lot of pot, and I found this stuff, Miracle Fruities, and...
Don't take it personally, Ricardo. We all used to smoke a lot of weed.
Yes. Dude. Do you want to take this one?
I don't even know what to do with this. I would just say that if it's called Miracle Fruities and it's claiming to change how you taste foods, it's probably a bad idea.
Yeah, and anything that can offer relative to the munchies that you're getting from smoking out all the time is probably pissing in the wind. So, I seem to remember seeing these. I forget where it was or when I got exposed to them, But it, and God, I think I actually tried it, and it did seem to change your perspective of food. It lasts like 5 minutes, so it's kind of like you know, if you brush your teeth and then go try to eat an orange, like it tastes terrible, kind of gig. And so these things, it seems like you'd need to be eating miracle fruities throughout your whole meal so that you take your bitter thing and it tastes sweet. And I'm not really too sure what bitter stuff you would be eating so that it would taste sweet, like orange peels or something. Like, I don't know. I do think.
Okay, so here it's a plant. A West African plant.
Yeah, it's kind of like stevia in a way, the way that it works.
Yeah. Weird.
So
I don't know. It seems like a bit of a stretch.
I feel like I probably need to smoke a bowl to be able to answer this thing, to get on the correct wavelength with this. But I think this stuff works. You might... but it's kind of like, to what end? I'm trying to figure out, like, what bitter foods you would eat so that it would, you know, make bitter foods taste sweet. And why not just have like some apples or oranges or some dark chocolate or something, and smoke less pot. Damn it, Ricardo.
So what is your opinion on marijuana and its effects on long-term health and strength training?
General, well, you know, it's a pretty potent phytoestrogen, for one. So if you are really, you know, battling to keep some sort of a, you know, good body comp, if you're thinking about like testosterone levels and all that stuff, it ain't good for it. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It's also hilarious to me, and this goes across the spectrum of like smokers. Folks will go out of their way to buy organic produce, and they'll filter their water, and they'll go to yoga, and they'll do this and that, and then they'll smoke a cigarette or they'll smoke pot. And there's like 6,000 different chemicals that you ingest because of the breakdown of the burning of organic matter. I mean, the stuff is horrible. I talked about tobacco versus nicotine gum, and like nicotine is pretty damn benign from a pharmacological or a toxicological standpoint, but it's all the other gnarly stuff in the plant that is like carcinogenic and stuff like that. So it's hilarious to me that if somebody is really focused on health and they're going out of their way to do all this other stuff, and then they're smoking something, there's kind of a screw loose with that. Like, if you really take it seriously, at the end of the day, I think that you could probably smoke a cigarette or two here and there, and it's really not all that big of a deal. It's probably a hormetic stressor, probably the same deal with marijuana. I think, as with all this stuff, it's kind of the poisons in the dose. What I find, though, is that most people who ask this question are, like, stoned all the time. So it's,
yes,
you know, and there's no doubt there's going to be some oxidative stress. I love all the videos of like the dudes who are like, I'm just like I was when I started smoking pot for the first time. It's like, wow. So you were lobotomized in the beginning, you know? And you know, I obviously the stuff's illegal. I'm very libertarian in that stuff. I think it's patently ridiculous, that we don't tax the stuff, and that, you know, drug dealers make money on it, but the government and society doesn't. That's fucking stupid. Like, I just can't wrap my head around that. The puritanical, litigious side of things is absolutely ridiculous. And you could incite me into a fight pretty easily on that topic. But all the health stuff, you know, I mean, it's kind of like, I just had somebody on Twitter. They were like, so is eating raw honey really that bad? And I'm like, come on, if you got to ask me, you got to know it's a problem. And it's kind of the same deal with this. You know, I mean, you kind of know in the back of your head that smoking something probably isn't all that good for you. And you know, I guess some moderation will mitigate the effects, but yeah.
Yeah. If the food has the word miracle in it, and if you're inhaling smoke, that's pretty good tip off that it's probably not a good idea.
I wonder if you could smoke Miracle Whip.
Probably. You gotta
dry it first.
Reduce it down somehow and dry it out first.
Or just have a really hot flame.
All right. Okay.
I think our listenership just fell off in half after that one. People were like,
they're all taking a smoke break right now.
I'm so done.
All right. Well, let's see if we can redeem ourselves with this next one. Probably not, because I just realized that it's addressed to me. All right. G-Money says, hey, guys, thanks to you both for living the dream for all of the rest of us. That just reminds me, just real quick, every time I talk to Michael Rutherford, for those of you who don't know who that is, he's the guy who did the Max Effort black box stuff that so many of you use. And just about every time I talk to him, he's like, hey, what's going on? Just living the dream out here in the Midwest. That's pretty much his response every time. It renders my humdrum day-to-day existence much more meaningful and rewarding when I can live vicariously through your exploits.
Oh, Lord.
Wow.
Oh, Lord.
It's a good thing you get only this small glimpse into our exploits.
Yeah.
Kidding aside, I've got some questions for Greg. Rob, chime in too. What are the essential training-based questions you think a prospective trainee should ask a trainer or gym before signing on? That is, assuming one can get clarity on the financial issues and the logistical issues, how can a trainee best determine that a prospective trainer knows their stuff, understands, and doesn't object to the trainee's goals, will work with the trainee to achieve his goals, and won't kill, maim, or injure the trainee in the process? If it's relevant to your answer, I'm a middle-aged guy, married with kids, work a desk job, been paleo for about 18 months, and have no known health issues or challenges, and my primary performance goal is to enjoy a long, high-quality, physically active life free of chronic degenerative disease. Well, I would say the number one thing directly regarding your questions about what to look for in the trainer is when you first talk to them, are they asking you questions to try to find out what you want to do,
mm-hmm.
or are they just telling you what they're going to do to you? And I think that's like a surefire tip off. If someone immediately isn't overwhelmingly interested in what you want and what your background has been and kind of your ideas on how to proceed, then they're probably not going to work well with you. That being said, I mean, you want someone who does have who actually does have some kind of established philosophy and methodology and kind of knows how to go forward to help you achieve your goals. But that's a different situation. And so that's something you definitely want to inquire about. What's your background? How long have you been training? You know, what kind of clients do you work with primarily? Asked to talk to their other clients too. And anyone who is worth their salt as a trainer will be more than happy to put you in contact with their other clients because they know that they're doing a good job and those other clients will sing their praises for them. Rob, you got anything to add?
No. I think that's legit. You touched on some stuff I was not thinking of. I agree with all of that. And I'd just throw in that you're probably then, to some degree, just going to have to try it on and test ride it a little bit. And this has been a little bit of my challenge getting back into jiu-jitsu on a consistent basis. I trained with John Frankel, who, in addition to being a black belt in jits, got his purple belt, I think, from Hickson. The dude has a PhD from Harvard in Korean literature. And then trained with Roy Dean, who is a phenomenal coach. I have trained as much as I can with Glenn Cordoza, although he's only a purple belt. He's just super, super technical. The guy's written 15 books on mixed martial arts training. So he's super, super good methodology. And I feel like I'm a reasonably good coach, and so I kind of know good coaching from bad coaching. And so it's been a challenge for me to find a scene where I'm like, okay, people are thinking about where we're trying to go with this and what my goals are, instead of just like throwing something against the wall and hoping it sticks. And so to some degree, after all of that pre-screening stuff that you do, you're probably just going to have to try it on for a certain amount of time and see how it goes.
That's a good point. You do actually have to train with somebody to know how it's going to work. And I think, you know, your question about someone who's not going to kill or maim you, you should know pretty quickly if it's heading in that direction. And so something that when we have new clients come in, I tell them very explicitly that I expect them to communicate with me or with whoever they're working with all the time. And it's like the moment they feel uncomfortable or they feel like something is improper or they're worried about it, they need to speak up. And so I think a lot of the times the trainees feel that they shouldn't be giving feedback or they don't want to feel like big babies and complain about something. But, you know, trainers, you know, we don't have like crystal balls or anything. If something is bothering you, we don't know. And unless you've disclosed every single, you know, tiny detail of your injury history and this and that, like we can't predict, you know, everything that's going to potentially aggravate, you know, a former problem or create a new one. So you really have to take responsibility too and make sure you're communicating with that trainer. And so your response from them, from that communication, should be pretty telling on how they're going to do. In other words, if they're immediately interested in kind of taking a step back, you know, reconsidering what you're doing, okay, how do we work around this to still try to achieve what we want to achieve without actually hurting you, that's a good trainer. If they just say, quit being a wiener and just do it, you know, you're probably looking at someone who isn't going to work for you long term.
And again, I like what you were saying about like interviewing some of their clients and stuff. Like if the clients that you get introduced to kind of look like you and kind of sound like you and kind of have similar goals and concerns as you do, probably a pretty good bet that you're going to have a good fit there. If you know, you're rolling in, you know, middle-aged dude or gal, and all of the people are like 18 to 22 years old, tattoos, you know, wallet chain and board shorts with their hat on backwards, you might want to run. You know, I mean, it just might not be the scene for you. And if the scene that I just described kind of awakens your pulse and you get mildly aroused at the thought of all that, then it's like that might be exactly the you know, the scene for you. So you definitely... I think that that's a great advice that Greg had on that.
And you know what? One more thing too is that I think it's important to distinguish between like good trainer versus bad trainer and kind of appropriate trainer versus inappropriate trainer. So kind of what Rob was saying is that you can have a trainer who kind of caters to certain demographic and, you know, certain type of person, certain types of goals, and they can be extremely good trainers, but they may not be appropriate for you because, you know, your goals and your situation are just not what they're experienced with, or it's not what they're super motivated to do. So I think, you know, in fairness, you need to kind of distinguish those two things and, you know, not necessarily write someone off as a bad trainer.
Just not
up to like, you know, what you're doing.
Yeah.
But that's an important thing. You can't say, oh, this guy has done so well for all these other athletes or all these other people, but they're doing completely different things from what I want to do. And so don't necessarily try to force fit yourself into a situation that's not going to work for you.
Yeah. We do a great job at NorCal, but every once in a while I'll get somebody that'll roll through the door and I'll send him or her to a guy in town who does kind of a bodybuilding approach. He does kind of a calorie restricted, high carb, you know, low fat kind of gig, but he gets really good results with the folks that he works with, and he just has a different pacing and style. And every once in a while, I'll ship somebody his direction because I just feel like they're a better fit than what we do, because we have kind of a certain philosophy and a certain way of doing things, and I feel like we're very dynamic, but at the same time, certain personalities, certain goals, just really aren't a good fit for what the gym is up to. And I would rather send them someplace where they're going to succeed than piss them off and piss us off at trying to, you know, square peg round hole kind of scenario.
Yes, we get those also. Like we had one woman come in here recently who was, she's pretty in shape, you know, pretty lean, pretty muscular in the upper body at least. And, you know, she tried a class and she's working with another trainer, and her description of what she was doing was a little odd, but it sounded like some kind of cross between sort of a bodybuilding approach, but then like a super narrow selection of CrossFit exercises, like, you know, doing the same exercise every single day was her conditioning thing, just doing a ton of them. And, you know, every single day she'd work up to a max lift on whatever it was. And it's kind of odd. But so, you know, her response to everything was like, oh, well, that's really different than what I'm doing now. Oh, well, that's really different from what I'm doing now. And it's kind of like, well, you're here looking for a new gym for a reason. You know what I mean? Like, you're clearly not satisfied with what you're doing or you wouldn't be here. So it was just a really odd reaction. But, you know, she was kind of kept going back to this, like, oh, well, my trainer says, you know, I need to get my arms a little bigger to match the size of my legs and stuff. And we were kind of like, okay, well, you know, if that's what you're interested in doing, that's all well and good, but you're not going to be able to do that well here. You know what I mean? And it's like you said, square peg, round hole. I'm sure not going to coerce someone to training here because it's just going to make my job miserable. It's going to make my trainer's jobs miserable, and it's going to make my other clients miserable. And so it's kind of, you kind of have to go for the good of the group over the good of the individual in cases like that. And she's probably better off with the trainer she's with currently, hopefully.
Cool.
All right.
Dude, you've got to read the subject line on this one.
It's an alliteration. Serious sunbed stress to subvert sad.
All Which right. I guess is seasonal affective disorder.
I would assume so.
Yes.
I think I have that right now. It's been 2 days with no sun. Chris says.
That's why we moved to Santa Fe and Reno instead of Palo Alto with you guys, because I would have blown my brains out.
Oh, come on. We get bad weather like 6 days of the year.
It must be every single time I visit, because the sun's never out when I see you guys. So
you've been here like two times. Every time. Shut up, Rob. All right. Chris says, Dear Rob and Greg, apologies for the pathetic attempt to draw attention to this with the dodgy subject line, but I guess I have to try something to get my question answered.
And
apparently
it worked.
Yeah. Bio, 42-year-old ex-soldier living in Northern Ireland. Been paleo/primal-ish for about 6 months via Slimming World, Cut the Fat podcast, and my friend, a personal trainer. Lost 2.5 stone in that time. That's about 35 of your American pounds. Thank you. I was going to have to Google convert that. And I'm now sitting at around 196 pounds. At 6'1", that's around as low as I want to go, but have more work to do to get into the six-pack territory, I suspect. I carry over some injuries that currently prevent me training to my full potential. Nothing dramatic, sore back, shoulder, etc. However, none of that has anything to do with my question. With paleo/primal, there are lots of references to vitamin D and appropriate levels of sunlight. Therein lies the problem for me. So much of the paleo-primal vibe seems to be coming out of parts of the world blessed with actual seasons, whereas I, living in Northern Ireland, have to put up with various degrees of rain and next to no sunlight throughout the year. It is especially bad now the winter is on its way, but to be honest, if we get 2 weeks of decent weather here, then we are lucky. But, as my granny used to say, there is no such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothes. So I've resorted to sunbeds and get myself right royally burnt. These sunbeds have moved on from when I last used them and found myself burnt within 5 minutes exposure. I've gone back today after 2 weeks away for a mere 3 minutes exposure and have that niggling doubt in my mind as to whether I'm doing the right thing. After all, Grok didn't lock himself in a ring of UV tubes, now did he? Conventional wisdom is banging on how sunbeds are bad and how we should cover up. I need to do something, as I'm sure I'm impacted by seasonal affective disorder, especially in the winter months. Sure, my lifestyle has changed with the modified diet and reintroduction of exercise, but my mood isn't exactly up on the up as a result. Curious for any guidance as you can provide, and thanks for the great podcast/website, etc. And many thanks from across the pond.
Wow, this is a good question, and it's something I've been researching. I've been trying to figure out. My concern with this stuff, gosh, use your words, Rob. Use your words.
Paint us a word picture.
I feel like a dog running around a fireplace right now. So, you know, what we're trying to emulate here, at least in my mind, good amounts of sunlight, but thinking about like volume and intensity type things, it starts sounding a lot like exercise and things like that, hormetic stressors. So I think if you're going to use this stuff, starting on the very, very short end, and it literally may be a minute for like your first exposures, particularly if you're, you know, living in Northern Ireland and your backside has never even seen light before. So that's one thing to consider. Like, there really is not too short of an exposure time that you could start with, 30 seconds or a minute. Now, granted, you're paying for this stuff, so that could be kind of painful at first. But you start off at that very, very low end, and then you could incrementally add 10 seconds per visit. Say, like, you do two visits at 30 seconds, then you could bump up two visits at 40 seconds, two visits at 50 seconds, and you slowly march yourself up and say you have two or three visits a week. And I think that would generally be pretty safe. The literature on this stuff definitely paints sunbeds in a pretty poor light. Sorry for the pun, but it doesn't look great with regards to like melanoma and stuff like that. But we also are suspecting now that malignant melanomas probably need a different or an additional environmental input, another epigenetic input, and we're kind of suspecting that it may be some sort of a grain or autoimmune type trigger related to transglutaminase. So that's kind of another element to this. So if you're going to do it, I would start on the very short side and then slowly, incrementally work your way up. If you miss a period of time going in, then I would dial your exposure back and then kind of march it forward. What I'm trying to figure out is, what is the approximate intensity, say, like, of a equatorial exposure versus like mid-latitude exposure at noon? And it's a little bit complex because you've got three different wavelengths of UV radiation that we need to consider. All of those have different impact on like DNA damage. And so I'm trying to figure out what would normal sunlight kind of look at with regards to like intensity of light per cubic centimeter on your skin. And then what does that mean with regards to kind of DNA issues, potential damaged DNA, overwhelming the oxidative capacity or the antioxidant capacity of our system? And what I'm trying to figure out is, could there be some beds put together, some UV beds, which this would be much longer and it wouldn't be as great of a financial deal because, the way that these tanning booths work right now, people can be in there 5 or 10 minutes. They can stack people back to back to back and just kind of go. But what if you had a much lower intensity, broad spectrum UV exposure in addition to some normal full wavelength light that you were being exposed to? Would that be both safer and more beneficial from like a seasonal affective disorder standpoint? And my gut sense is maybe yeah. And do those bulbs exist? Could you set that up on kind of a home operation? So I've been doing actually a fair amount of research trying to look into all that stuff and figure out what a smart recommendation would be. But in the interim, like if I were this person facing this issue, then I would probably start on the short end, like 30 seconds, and kind of march my way up with knowledge that there might be some downside to this, but the light deprivation for me, I mean, it is such a deal breaker. If it shortens my life, that's okay. Because if I'm stuck in Seattle or Northern Ireland for an extended period of time, I'm going to end up sticking my head under a bus tire or something like that anyway. So,
start that seems kind of dramatic, Rob.
Seems a little dramatic.
Make a scene about it.
Well, okay, just a gun then. So, start on the short end, and I'm trying to figure out some information about volume and intensity on this stuff so that maybe we can answer this in a little more educated way. And maybe there are some different types of bulbs that you could even buy, like a home tanning bed kind of gig, that you might be in there for a half hour and it would be very, very analogous to like a half hour of sun exposure, say at a middle latitude at noon. So it would be a significant amount, but it wouldn't be, say, like as intense as standard sunbeds.
All right. Okay. The subject of this one is, I've got to go. How long? That's what she said. No, this is not a sex question. K. Kate says, "Dear Rob and Greg, I wasn't going to put this part, but figured Greg would appreciate my following proper letter etiquette." Well, I don't mind. It has not been formatted like a letter. You just go with what's in your heart, Kate. One thing that struck me that Rob said in podcast 104, we should be able to manage a 6, 10, even 18-hour swing without food fairly well. In his words, it shouldn't wreck us. I know that I've come a long way from testing positive for hypoglycemia to being able to survive a couple hours between meals, but I don't know if I could go more than 6 hours without eating and not getting wrecked. In 18 hours, WTF, no way. It's totally logical that we should be able to manage those things since there was definitely a point in time when our ancestors had to make do without food for a length of time, so we should still be able to do that. But I wonder if I'm not as fat adapted as I need to be, if I'm fairly certain I'd be in trouble if there was zero food around for a day or so. To further improve fat adaptation, I wonder if reducing carbs and upping the fat makes sense. Although Rob and others seem to be leaning towards a moderate carb approach in non-metabolically deranged folks, I am not deranged, or maybe work up to being able to eat larger, well-balanced meals so there's enough fuel to go longer. My meals are likely around 400 calories of paleo love. So, Rob, what's the, quote, long and short of it? Some background. Not sure how much of this needed for the question, but here you go anyway. 5'6", 137-pound fitness trainer, went paleo in May of this year. Tested positive for gluten intolerance 4 years ago and was doing gluten-free with all the wonderful gluten-free grains, still jacking with my blood sugar levels, but all that's out now that I'm paleo. Have been working on gut issues, likely stemming back to not getting fed any breast milk as an infant. Imagine the guilt trip I can use on my mother with that one. That were helped by going gluten-free, then going paleo, then cutting the nuts and eggs to almost zero. I'm fully on board paleo, only do corn tortillas maybe twice a month. If I had to pick a percent, as others are prone to do, let's go with 96.3% paleo.
Nice.
Currently take probiotics, enzymes, etc., as well as fish oil. I also currently supplement for my adrenals with some adrenal and phosphatidylserine per my naturopath's guidance. I don't know why I couldn't read phosphatidylserine. It looked like a totally different word to me for a minute.
It's spelled
wrong. Probably because it's two words. There we go.
And it's spelled wrong, yeah.
Used to not be able to go any length of time without getting hangry. Hungry plus angry equals hangry. And now I don't get hangry until I hit the 4+ hour mark of not eating. That's why I seriously doubt I could go longer without eating. Workouts. Sprint workouts once a week, long, slow run once a week, strength training that combines big lifts with some stability core work 3 times a week. No workout lasts longer than an hour. It's off season from endurance running where I run up to half marathon distances. What can a person, got to keep this somewhat impersonal so Rob doesn't get fired up again about people asking for diagnoses over the internet, do in this instance work at becoming more fat adapted so I mean a person like me could be more optimally fit, leaner, sexier, and frankly so I can boast about my insane fat adapted body? Thanks.
I just think that it's amazing that we now have a listenership that is both more full of shit and bigger smart asses than we are, which is absolutely amazing.
it's our own fault.
It's like some sort of fruit fly selective breeding. We've just weeded out anybody that's reasonable, and we're left with this. So no, this is awesome. There's a very long question, and kind of the short answer to this.
What's the long and short of it, Rob?
The long and the short of it is eating more fat will tend to, you know, ramp up fat mobilizing enzymes, so you'll tend to be more fat adapted. In transient sense, you're more insulin resistant, but that doesn't really matter because we're not using glucose as primary a fuel. If you've got some adrenal issues, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. Some intermittent fasting can help in this regard. I think in general, and you know, the iCaveman gig was, I think, pretty illustrative of all this stuff. Like, I went into that in a ketogenic state, didn't eat anything. So, I mean, I was basically like running primarily off fat, catabolizing a little bit of protein, but that's kind of the uptick of ketosis, is it dramatically curtails the breakdown of proteins as a catalytic cofactor in metabolism. So it's good in that regard. And I got more and more tired throughout the week while I was there because I just didn't eat any food. And you start getting some down regulation of your metabolic output because your brain doesn't want you to starve. But I was able to chug along, and I didn't have energy dips, and I was tired because I slept poorly, and I didn't have food in general, but it wasn't like a hangry kind of gig. So, sleep, overall training, those are all factors that could play into this, and it might also be a deal where you might just have to be uncomfortable for a chunk of time to push that additional fat adaptation. And I'm really kind of guessing at this. Like, we've seen enough situations, depending on how people are sleeping and how they're living, that seem to look like some elevated cortisol levels from either intermittent fasting or from too long of low carb, that it now makes me kind of nervous to really recommend that. Just across the board. I mean, obviously, I still think that that's very, very appropriate for folks. It's actually closer to how I eat more so than not. But, you still have to keep an eye on who's appropriate for all that stuff. So, yes, you should be able to go an extended period of time without eating and have it totally crush you. How you get to that point, I'm still not super clear on, because given the way that we have to live our lives, like, are you getting as much sleep as you need? Do you have the photo period that is good and healthy and all that stuff? Like, so there's other pieces to this that are important to consider. And to get to that more fat adapted spot, there might be some kind of collateral damage with it on the way there. And I'm not 100% clear on that.
All right. This is a paleo during the end of the world as we know it. Michael says, "Hello, Rob and Greg. My apologies if this question has already been submitted and answered. I'm pretty sure that it has not because I just finished listening to all of the podcasts, starting with the first one. The psychotherapist stated that my prognosis is marginal at best."
Shocker.
Smiley face. In planning for the coming financial meltdown / zombie apocalypse, possibly the most affordable long-lasting foods to stock are rice and beans. Typically, the recommended approach is to consume the older food stock before it goes bad and rotate in new bags of rice and beans. But in the opinion of several paleo authorities, those types of food are problematic. What should the paleo survivor be stockpiling in his or her closet? Thank you.
Dude, I've literally rattled this idea around, and
that's a frightening thought.
Yeah, yeah. A 50-gallon drum of coconut oil. Because
where does one procure a 50-gallon drum of coconut oil?
Alibaba.com. Basically, it's all the like Chinese, manufacturing stuff, and you can get everything off that site. So
nice.
50-gallon drum of food grade coconut oil because it's effectively inert. You could in a pinch add some liquefaction elements to it and probably run it in some sort of a biodiesel format, although that's really not all that much fuel, but it's just a whole lot of calories there. The white rice idea isn't bad. Really you got right down to it, coconut oil, because you've got a massive amount of calories there. It's inert. It won't go bad. You won't get weevils in it, et cetera, et cetera. A bunch of white rice, which can get weevils, can go bad. Beans are, if you do the beans and rice thing, theoretically, you've kind of sort of got a complete protein. But you've got to cook them, and you've got to cook them reasonably well, or else you're going to potentially have some like GI problems with it. But and that starts begging the question about are you gonna have fuel for a fire and all that sort of jive. So in my mind, it would probably be more like the 50-gallon drum of coconut oil, a whole lot of rice, maybe 5, 6, 10 bags of white rice that you try to hermetically seal to keep weevils out of them. And then I'll probably be supplementing my protein and omega-3, omega-6 intake, because you're going to be essential fat deficient with that stuff, and you're going to be protein deficient with that stuff. So you're going to have to supplement that with, local neighborhood animals, zombies, or, whatever it is that you get your hands on. But in a legit kind of survival situation, that's kind of my thought, is something along that line, and maybe some sort of a stockpiled freeze-dried meat and all that sort of jive. But there's an interesting element to this if you really want to go far down the rabbit hole, and if you remember good calories, bad calories, when Gary Tobbs was talking about some of the starvation studies that they did, when they were feeding them a higher carbohydrate, basically a starvation level diet, these people were super hungry and they became nutrient deficient. Because something that people forget, particularly, you know, like the nutritional sciences realm and doctors and all the rest of that stuff, is that carbohydrates require B vitamins as cofactors in their metabolism. And something like white rice elevates your need for B vitamins. And so whereas like if you're in a ketogenic state, the other side of this is when they were talking about like the Vilhelmir Stefansson experiment, where the guy lived with the Inuit for a number of years and basically ate a all meat diet, you know, protein and fat, and you get a little bit of carbs out of the glycogen, and you also get some vitamins and minerals and all that out of that stuff. But there's no doubt that a ketogenic diet decreases your need for vitamin and mineral cofactors as compared to, say, like eating crackers and rice. This is a lot of the problem that the explorers faced with things like scurvy. Like, they would get vitamin C deficient. And Tobbs did a really good job of kind of tracing that stuff out. And this is where all this stuff kind of loops back again and again. A ketogenic diet, maybe it's not 100% appropriate for everybody all the time, but it's really interesting that it minimizes your need for nutrients, B vitamins, vitamin C, etc. Like, it decreases it because we're decreasing these carbohydrate cofactors that elevate your need for them. Fruits and vegetables probably provide more than adequate levels of nutrients to act as cofactors. Grains do not, and that's why people who consume too many grains end up dying from vitamin and mineral deficiencies, like pellagra and stuff like that. So it's an interesting perspective on all that stuff. So if you're really thinking about the zombie apocalypse and how you would play that one out, you know, I'm actually thinking more on the ketogenic side of things, just from like a vitamin mineral deficiency kind of standpoint, versus being surrounded by a bunch of denuded grain products that then I'm going to have to get vitamins and minerals, you know, from somewhere. And I guess you could get your Optimum Nutrition like animal pack and pop one of those a day and, you know, have like a 10-year supply of that stuff in there. But if you're really, you know, going down the survivalist rabbit hole, I would think other routes besides just simply stockpiling a bunch of grains.
Wow, that was a remarkably well thought out answer. I have to say, I was not expecting that.
Well, I give a little thought to this. The state of the market.
Thought. That's a lot more than a little thought.
Oh yeah, it's a lot more than a little thought. The state of the markets and all the rest of the stuff. It makes me think a little bit. I know Brazil's economy is on the uptick. Yeah, totally. But it makes me wonder a little bit. I've got a backpack and some survival chow and stuff like that in case the bottom fell out of whatever it was we were doing. And I generally have some food squirreled away, and I have a water purification apparatus so that, you know, you can take raw sewage and turn it into something potable reasonably easily. So I've given a little thought to that stuff. I'm very middle of the road or moderate on this relative to the, like, you know, it is going to be the zombie apocalypse and everything's going to collapse. I just finished reading 1491 as per the recommendations of Kurt Harris, which was phenomenal. And now I'm reading The Rational Optimist, and which is an amazing book. I'm going to do kind of a blog post on kind of some thoughts I've had from both of the books. But I think we could see some sort of like a seriously wacky market meltdown kind of gig. But the interesting thing is, the more and more networked the world has become, the more interdependent the world has become, it seems more and more difficult for, you know, isolated market variables to cause something like a mass starvation or something like that. Like, if they completely pinched off the oil, yeah, I guess that could cause some serious problems, but then everybody starts shifting into natural gas, and, you know, the more we diversify the global economy and the more free market we have everything, actually the more stable, and it looks more like a highly diversified ecological picture versus like a you know, what is it, those globes that they sell, like a fairy shrimp and a snail, and then there's some sort of like algae that grows on the inside of it, and it's kind of like a stable biosphere. But if one of those variables goes, you know, it's done. And so the more dynamic our economy gets, typically the safer we are and the better we are. And then when we start getting into protectionist type activities and not realizing that we're just transitioning through different types of, you know, we went from a industrial, you know, agriculture, then industrial revolution, and now we're in kind of an information society. America has outsourced all of its manufacturing. It causes a lot of upheaval, but if we kind of roll with that and adapt with it instead of trying to do some sort of historical revisionism, then we should do pretty good. But I guess this is a nutrition show, not a political one, so I guess I'll stop there.
Well, it's also your show.
So. I guess that's true. Everybody gets pissed. I always get one of these pithy little pingers, though, when I'm throwing out the libertarian stuff, like on Facebook or something, and it's always been a chick thus far. And they're always like, I like your nutrition. Keep the politics to yourself. And I'm basically like, well, it's a fucking package deal. So read what you want or
go. Oh, man, that sounded a lot like somebody else I know. Better watch it.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, I don't know. My delusions of grandeur are much less diluted, though. So. Okay,
that's good. All right. Well, I'll stick around and try to keep it less serious then.
That's episode 106 on the books. So what, the next one, I should be back to Reno full time. So we'll see if we navigate moving the gato and the wife and all that stuff out here.
Cool.
Sweet, dude. Thanks, Greg.
Have fun with that move.
Yeah, seriously. Talk to you later, man.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, see bye. You.